Well, it is Thanksgiving week, and we started with a full room here in the Political Rewind studio. I, by the way, was just telling our panelists today that we're now Alexified. You can, if you're an Alexa household, you can say, Alexa, open GPB, and then say Political Rewind. And she will start playing the latest show, to which you, Mr. Galloway, said...
I don't want Alexa in my house.
Oh, okay. I thought you maybe didn't want Political Rewind.
No, playing. I download you guys, us guys, all the time. It's just I don't like this stranger talking to the stranger in my house.
I understand it. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the AJC, and he oversees, of course, Politically Georgia, the AJC blog. Always great to have Jim here on Mondays and Fridays. We're also joined today by Rusty Paul, the mayor of Sandy Springs, former colleague of Jack Kemp, worked for Kemp at Housing and Urban Development back in the days when we called it HUD,
yep.
And worked on his presidential campaign. Rusty, thank you. I know things are hopping up in Sandy Springs, so thanks for taking some time to be here.
I only come out of Sandy Springs to see you down here, Bill.
Okay, good. Julianne Thompson, a Republican consultant, is back with us. And Julianne, your former officer in the Republican State Party, are you ready for your Thanksgiving?
Most definitely. Ready to take a break from politics, too.
Well, okay. And Senator Steve Henson, the minority leader in the state Senate, is back with us. Steve, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So let's do this. Because we have you here, Mayor Paul, and also we have one of the leaders of the legislature with us, let's start with a conversation about transportation. Jim, they had a really fascinating meeting. A number of the elected officials along that northern arc a couple weeks back. Jim, we always think about transit in terms of north-south movement. We think about up 400. We think about it going mostly north-south, and all of a sudden the conversation is east-west as well.
Yeah, I mean I-75 going to Dunwoody, you got to hit that 285 thing, and you've got all this limited geography on the arc. I guess what is now the northern arc, instead of the one that Roy Barnes wanted to put there. So you've got all this competition for space here that's going to get filled up really quick.
So who was part of that meeting, and what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, we had mayors. They were all mayors from representatives of cities. They were there. Some, not all of them, were mayors. We had some city council members because certain mayors couldn't be there. From all of the cities, starting in Smyrna, going across to Doraville. With Brookhaven, Dunwoody, Sandy Springs as well, knowing that the Georgia Department of Transportation is about to add significant capacity, both they're in the process of doing it on 400 and parts of 285 through Sandy Springs and Dunwoody, but all the way around, and there's a growing realization that you can't continue, you know, as our population grows from, you know, when I got here we were less than a million. We're going to 8 million in the next 20 years or so. You can't continue to move everybody in one person per vehicle increments. So how do we, before Georgia Department of Transportation, which is doing magnificent work in trying to give us more capacity, how can we squeeze in a transit option when east-west is really as important among those cities as is north and south?
Yeah, I think anybody, Steve Henson, who commutes ever, I shouldn't even say commutes, whether you commute or just occasionally get on 285, go in the wrong direction at rush hour, you recognize how dense the traffic is east and west.
It used to be rush hour. Now at 10 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you can run into the mess that is 285. And it affects everybody. I mean, if you're, you know, we talk about the northern area, but that, it, you know, traffic coming from the south, from Stone Mountain or Lithonia, business trucks trying to go around 285. We're impacting business all over metro area where we have a roadblock. And many of us have been screaming for 20 years or more that we need to do more on transit. So, you know, the speaker's got his study commission going, and we hopefully are working in that direction to move more thoroughly to promote a transit program.
So what do you see? I mean, you're going to need them at the legislature, Rusty. What is the next step on trying to figure out an option east-west?
Well, one of the shocking things is that we've been talking about transit in Metro Atlanta since the 1960s, when MARTA was originally founded. There is no regional transit plan. It doesn't exist. And that's one of the problems that we're going to have, because GDOT's moving at the speed of light to widen to 400 and 285, and there's no plan. And GDOT says, well, we can't put space in an area when there is no plan. So we're all struggling. How do we get a plan together in time to be able to reserve it? While you're not going to be able to broaden the number of pathways through these mature communities. Go back to the Stone Mountain Freeway or the real Northern Arc, as you referred to it earlier. You're just not going to be able to do it. So you're going to have to use the existing rights of way on these major thoroughfares to be able to put it in. You're going to have to go three-dimensional, maybe even four-dimensional. You may have to go underground, but that's extremely expensive. So if we can figure out how to do it while we're doing the 285-400 expansion, at least leave some space for it. We can't build it, but can we at least reserve some area so that we can continue the dialogue?
Julianne, Rusty Paul, of course, is a Republican mayor, but he is going to face, there are Republicans at the Capitol, continue to be, in the legislature, Steve Henson has to deal with them on this, who continue to be somewhat resistant, as do some rural Democrats as well, those who are left down there, to this whole notion of transit.
Sure. Well, I think it depends on the constituency. And there are some, especially where I'm from in Gwinnett, that are still leery of expanding transit. And but like the mayor said, there was no plan in place. We grew so fast, and the infrastructure just can't keep up. So something has to be done. So I'm encouraged about this.
Well, I think people are saying the Cab and Fulton residents have paid a price to develop MARTA over the years, and that it's been a big attribute to the whole state. And now the whole state sees that they need to pick up, or otherwise we're going to have a mess in Metro Atlanta that's going to affect everybody.
And I think you do have some movement in Gwinnett County, Julianne. I mean, Charlotte Nash creeps ever closer.
Chairwoman out there.
She's of the county commission there. She creeps ever closer to endorsing a transit line, a rail line of some sort. And you know, the recent experience of the I-85 burning down is one of the many reasons that that's happening.
All right, go ahead.
I think Amazon sent probably the greatest wake-up call. Plus, in Gwinnett, you've seen a huge number of their major employers move into the Midtown area because of transit, and also to get access to what Bud Peterson's doing at Georgia Tech.
Right, and president of Georgia
right.
Tech.
And so
and Amazon, just to clarify on Amazon, what happened was, what has happened is that Fulton and DeKalb, because they have transit, can be part of this Amazon hunt, but Cobb and Gwinnett and multiple other counties.
Forsyth, all the rest of the counties outside. And there's a growing realization. I mean, we had Mercedes come to Sandy Springs because of transit. Now, you've got car manufacturers who are saying transit's important. And so if you can't check that box, you're going to be really behind in your economy as you grow.
All right, let me just be clear about a couple of different strands of this conversation. What you're talking about, Rusty Paul, is you're not proposing, with all of the mayors and other city officials up your way, you're not proposing funding to begin any kind of construction. It's simply asking GDOT to include in their master plan for expanding 285 a place where transit could eventually go.
That's correct.
Steve Henson, you all are going to start looking for real money to get some of these projects moving forward.
Well, a couple things. I understand Rusty's consideration in Northside, but we would like DTOT to take that into account wherever they do development, you know, that they consider transit long-term and start looking at a long-term plan. And, yes, we need to start looking at more money. We did House Bill 170 that got some more money to transportation, but I don't think there's going to be enough there to really fund transit. We're going to have to look at some additional streams of revenue to put transit where it needs to be in this state.
And Jim Teasblasts are faring better these days in local communities than they sure did back when the statewide effort to have T-splats in the regional segments of the state failed to move anywhere here in Metro, at least.
Right, right. But you've got competition now. There was just something in the Marietta Daily Journal this weekend where they're contemplating a penny sales tax for law enforcement paychecks, yeah. which would, of course, that would damage any attempt to fund a countywide version of transit MARTA hookups in Cobb County.
Okay. So we'll watch that conversation unfold. Clearly, Steve Henson, we're going to be watching what happens at the legislature.
Yeah, I'm hoping for a statewide investment on it, not county by county.
All right, we're going to put that on the board, Steve Henson, statewide investment, and we'll keep checking back on that. Thank you. Let's move on. Mayor Kasim Reed, like Savannah, which is doing the same thing, the city of Atlanta has had a task force, essentially, studying this whole question of what to do about Confederate monuments, Confederate memorials of various kinds, hamstrung by the fact that there's a statute in effect that prevents local jurisdictions from doing anything without the approval of the legislature. Nevertheless, this task force has met in Atlanta several times, and Mayor Reed was on the air, I think on Friday, Galloway, with our friend Dennis O'Hare over at WABE, and he gave a pretty strong hint that we're going to get some street name changes. This task force is going to report that
out.
That's
the low-hanging fruit. That the 2001 deal over the 1956 state flag touched on memorials and statues, but it didn't specifically go after the protection of street names. So the city thinks that it's got the power to change that.
All right, Stephen Fowler, who is a producer of All Things Considered here in Atlanta, is with us in the studio for a couple of minutes. Stephen, you covered at least one of these public hearings on this issue. What do you have to report out on that?
So the public hearing, the last one, where they put together all of their recommendations, basically put things into several categories. One, there were monuments that exist around Atlanta that need a little bit more context as to why they're there, who put them there, what it stands for. Some of the monuments, they said, probably better off taken away, put somewhere else, or just gone, period. And then the street names, most of the street names with ties to the Confederacy, they say should be changed as soon as possible, or as somebody said, immediately. And one of those is Confederate Avenue in East Atlanta. It connects Grant Park and Ormwood Park from Boulevard all the way over to Moreland, and it was named after the Confederate soldier's home that was built in the late 1800s and raised in about 1965.
So we expect the mayor at some point today has said he will in fact announce the outcome of this. Am I correct?
Yes. And the recommendation of the committee is to change those names, and his indication is that he will go along with that, and Confederate Avenue will soon be a thing of the past. So I spent last week on Confederate Avenue talking to a lot of business owners, homeowners, and community members about their perspectives, and most of them are happy to see the name change. Perhaps the most poignant example is a predominantly black Pentecostal church that sits on the corner of Confederate and Ormwood Avenues, and they don't even acknowledge that Confederate Avenue is their address. And I talked to Bishop O.C. Allen after a Sunday church service yesterday, and he says there's a pretty strong reason that they're not using that address.
Because we're people of color and our relationship to words and symbols, we knew immediately that using the Confederate street name as our address would conjure questions and could subtly just impact people mentally and emotionally.
And, you know, that's a perspective that's echoed by a lot of people that I talked to. I met with a man named Joe Thomas who started the petition to change the name of Confederate Avenue that now has almost 9,000 signatures. And he said growing up, he lived in the area and the school bus dropped him off and picked him up at Confederate Avenue. And he said that, you know, keeping that name there signifies that that's something that Atlanta supports and stands for, and he doesn't think that's the Atlanta that he's grown up.
Yeah, and the State Patrol's headquarters on Confederate Avenue,
right. DMV office, and just as a point of history, this is part of the Grant Park area, yeah. And that's where the Cyclorama once was, which was kind of the feature in the 40s, 50s, and 60s as a kind of a shrine to the Confederacy.
Yeah, let me open this up to everybody. I thought one of the most interesting questions that Dennis O'Hare asked the mayor when he was on the show the other day was, growing up in Atlanta, as Kasim did, did he think about the streets that were named for Confederate generals, other Confederate leaders? And the mayor's response, well, it wasn't a big part of his consciousness, I think, characterizes what he had to say. But, you know, I open this to any of you. It strikes me it'd be very difficult when I listen to the minister, Bishop Allen, to deal with this way. Anybody want to pick up on this? Julianne?
Well, sure. I go back to a press conference that we saw probably about a month and a half ago, where there were members of the Sons of the Confederacy as well as Black Lives Matter, and it was just a few from each group, and it's a press conference that they did together, where they were talking about the fact that in the end they still disagreed about the fate of Confederate monuments, but the fact that they got together and opened those lines of communication and did talk about the concerns of both sides really did do a lot of healing among those specific groups of people. So I think that open lines of communication and certainly understanding where someone is coming from on this is the direction that we need to go in.
Steve, maybe you can tell me if I'm right. Elena Perron has already dropped some legislation that intended to
overturn the statute which would prevent local jurisdictions from acting independent of the legislature, right?
Correct. Mary Margaret Oliver and Elena Perron are both dropping legislation. I think Senator Lester Jackson is going to drop some legislation allowing local control of the decision-making on these statutes.
And the key will be, of course, whether they can find Republicans to support it. And there have been a few of them who have said that the local control issue is important.
Rusty, you don't have much of a concentration of Confederate memorials up there in Sandy Springs, because your constituents are mostly from New York and Chicago.
We have one, Lake Forest Drive.
Oh. Is it named for Nathan?
Two R's in Forest.
Nathan Bedford.
And it's named after the lake, and I assume the lake was named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Well, and of course, he was one of the most
Founders KKK.
Right? Yeah, he was the founder of the KKK.
And we have a school in Sandy Springs, brand new school, about 5 or 6 years old, and they took one of the R's out when they named it after the road that it goes in front of as symbolic. Look,
that's an interesting way to handle it.
There is absolutely nothing more powerful in politics than symbolism. Nothing. The substance is always washed away by the symbols. My concern, and history doesn't end. You know, we should be celebrating our history today as much as we've celebrated old history. The only thing I worry about in this is you can't change history by erasing history. And whoever is telling the story of history, the story of history changes based on our perspective. And I'd much rather use these as symbols to explain what was wrong with that system, rather than just try and wash it away totally.
Well, you know, you have monuments, some of them that have information on them that are trying to describe history a way that we no longer believe
to romanticize.
I don't disagree with that, Steve.
So we need to either do two things. We need to take those things that are misleading away, or we need to provide educational context there with them, and that cost money and time and effort too.
No question.
And so, for instance, you know, like in Stone Mountain, if you don't remove the things off Stone Mountain, you should have a museum at the bottom that tells the both, kind of like the Holocaust Museum, costs about the war and, you know, in a complex and complete way, because, you know, the suffering is not totally understood when you look at the romantic
and I fully agree
symbols
with that.
Out there. But
I fully agree with that. I'm an English literature major. I did something I haven't done in 40 years. I read Faulkner. I couldn't read it in college, and it was a throwback, going back and reading Faulkner. It's same way with reading Mark Twain. The language, the terminologies, the way they frame the characters are shocking today.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear him talk about that, symbols. It is important. It's important we address this issue.
Yeah, no question.
Stephen, what was were most of the people in the city of Atlanta's public hearing against Did they mostly want changes made? Was there a fairly significant constituency that said, no, 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 we need to preserve our history?
There are a number of people that obviously don't want the name to change, but for different reasons. Some of the people that I talk to and some of the people that have been posting on social media say they're not looking forward to the actual logistical process of changing the names. Business owners having to update their websites and everything like that. But for the most part, even the people that are fans of history have said that they want the name gone so that their community can focus on their community and not have the shadow. Speaking to the point about symbols, you know, Joe Thomas told me that street names are the ones that are the most powerful and should be taken away because it's not like every time you go on the street, you see Confederate Avenue, which was named after the Confederate soldiers' home, which was here 50 years ago, but is no longer here. Like, they, you know, we do have, you know, historic Ted Turner Drive at Spring Street, which is pretty close, but, you know, there's no way to contextualize a street name. And so that's why there's been this big push to change the name and why everyone, for the most part, has been okay with it.
All right, Stephen, you, we appreciate your coming in and talking to us a bit about that. You've got a piece that's going to be on in our Atlanta, on all things considered here in Atlanta. Is it going to go statewide?
Statewide.
Oh, Stephen, you're growing by leaps and bounds. That'll be great. So that's going to be on ATC this afternoon.
Yep, at 4:45, 5:45, or 6:45.
All right. Stephen Fowler, thank you so much for being with us. We got to get a break in when we come back. Let's talk a bit about the latest in the Roy Moore story, especially because our very own Johnny Isaacson may have a role to play down the road in that saga. This is Political Rewind.
I have been silenced for 20 years.
Are we experiencing a cultural shift when it comes to outing sexual misconduct?
The more women speak out, the more other women want to speak out.
The touching and the being too close.
Suddenly, people are talking about it. And what about the men? I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Join me for a special broadcast, Sexual Harassment, The Moment of Reckoning, from NPR News.
Join us for an important discussion on sexual harassment Tuesday afternoon at 2, right here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. We're joined by Julianne Thompson, Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs, State Senator Steve Henson, Minority Leader in the Senate, and, of course, Jim Galloway from the AJC. Let's talk Roy Moore for a little while, because that story just isn't going away. It's a gift that keeps on giving. And I think one of the interesting developments today is to talk very briefly. AL.com is a statewide website that is maintained by the company which owns the major newspapers in the big cities of Alabama.
Birmingham News, the Montgomery Advertiser.
Huntsville Times.
And if you were to read their hard dead tree edition, the newspapers themselves, you would have found yesterday a editorial played what we used to call above on the roof, above the logo of the newspaper, essentially endorsing the Democrat, Doug Jones, condemning Roy Moore. And just let me read you a couple of lines. A vote for Roy Moore sends the worst kind of message to Alabamians struggling with abuse. If you ever do tell your story, Alabama won't believe you, or worse, we'll believe you, but we just won't care. To be clear, it's not only his record on women and children that disqualifies Moore. If we vote for Roy Moore, Alabama will also show we don't care about you if you're gay or Muslim or Catholic, if you're an atheist or an immigrant. We'll show each other that we only care about Roy Moore's definition of Alabama, and there is not room for the rest of us. Julianne, I thought one of the things that's interesting is Kellyanne Conway did one of the morning shows this morning, and she essentially, once again, ducked condemning Roy Moore, but said, well, you know, we need his vote in the Senate. Is this the sort of thing Republicans really want to stand by?
Well, first of all, this is a very difficult topic, of course. I saw the segment that you were talking about, and I think that the reason that she was as circumspect as what she was is for a variety of reasons. Number one, the White House has been very adamant that they want the citizens of Alabama to vote and to decide who their next senator is going to be. As I said, this is very difficult. On one hand, you certainly do not want to say that you don't believe accusers, and I certainly don't want to be accused of that hypocrisy, because I believed Juanita Broderick. So, you know, so we're in that kind of a situation. And I think that this is sort of a come to Jesus moment for both sides of the aisle. And I think that it's something that we need to talk about. And I think that it's a growing problem.
Rusty?
Yeah, as I said before we came on the air, I grew up about 5 miles from where Roy Moore lives. I didn't know that. I found that out when I go back to a high school football game every year, and my classmates were talking. And I've gone back since all this stuff's broken and asked them, what do you think? Because they asked me what I thought at the time. And they said, well, you know, this happened 50 years ago. Roy Moore's been a circuit court judge, Supreme Court judge. Why hasn't all this stuff come out? They honestly see it through the lens of this is the national media trying to disparage a guy over something that may have happened 50 years ago. Whether that's legitimate or not, that's kind of the perception that a lot of people in rural Alabama have. Why is it just now coming up as long as this guy's been involved in politics? And you really do have a divide in the state of Alabama right now between the urban, suburban areas and those rural areas that he so closely identifies with, and it's going to be interesting to see. I think you're going to probably have a record turnout over there in a special election, particularly.
And to your point, Rusty, I can see why they would be asking why now, mm-hmm. and the answer, of course, is because even statewide media doesn't get all that involved in Supreme Court judicial races. They don't get all that deeply involved in elections for DA. Or superior court judges.
They're circuit court judges in Alabama.
Circuit court judges, and so the level of scrutiny is not there. But there are people in Gadsden, Alabama,
yeah.
who remember that Roy Moore was barred from, or at least closely watched, whenever he walked into the local mall.
And I think that's why it has. And look, people's expectations, values change over time. And I think that's the reason today. I mean, you've got people all the way from Al Franken to Roy Moore who and all kinds of folks in between now that are coming back to answer for their behavior previously.
Well, I just want to make sure, Steve Henson, I'll come to you, that while we know that times change, I know you're not suggesting that it was appropriate if, in fact, Roy Moore was approaching a 14-year-old girl, no matter what year.
Yeah, I understand you for that clarification.
Yeah, I want to make sure that our listeners get that. Yeah.
Well, and there's something, you look at the Trump election where there are certain allegations out there, too, and having one Alabama big, could you compare the two? But you see a lot of these charges are becoming more personal, and people are coming forward telling more completely their stories and in a more detailed, personal way. So I think it's going to affect his vote a good bit. The question is, of course, as Rusty mentioned, turnout, what it's going to be in the election. And also what we're going to look at, too, is how much is Alabama vested on the principles that are coming out of D.C. right now. Is this tax cut really something they are wanting so bad, raising the deficit $1.5 trillion, where we see most of the gains or, you know, winnings going to the rich and less so to those people making $75,000 or under? You know, happened in Washington on health care and other things, is that really something to motivate the Republican base to get out and want another vote on?
I think Julianne wants an Orrin Hatch moment here.
I was just going to bring up the fact that is not, unfortunately, in the state of Alabama, that is not something that they're talking about right now. That's not something that they're focusing on in this race. And, of course, I'm a Republican, but if I were advising a Democrat who was running for this race, I would tell him to stay away from the issues that he's focusing on, which are revisiting the Second Amendment and things like that, that really are not going to play well with Alabamans, despite the fact that they're Republican or Democrat. And I would focus on more issues like tax reform, but he's not.
So, you know, let's, if we can, move this into an area where it really actually could be of impact on us here. Jim Galloway, there is a scenario now being discussed, of course, that if Roy Moore wins, Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader McConnell, will immediately move, trigger actions that would have him removed from that seat. And if that happens, it's likely that would all play out in the Ethics Committee, which is chaired by?
By Johnny Isaacson. It's one of two committees that he's the only guy up in the Senate who chairs two committees. The other is Veterans Affairs. But he's got usually they give you the Ethics Committee as an extra because it's not that heavy a lift. But now he's got Roy Moore. He'll probably have to look into Al Franken and Bob Menendez out of New Jersey. And the Roy Moore one is Johnny Isaacson would be asked to make the case for denying Roy Moore a seat.
And Isaacson has already said that he does not think Roy Moore has the moral fiber to be in the United States Senate. He said that to the Marietta Rotary a couple weeks ago.
It's going to be interesting. I mean, as Steve knows, every once in a while in the legislature, you get these kinds of issues that you just wonder why you ever decided to run for office to begin with because of the complexity, and they're no-win situations, and that's the situation that Johnny Isaacson is going to find himself in. There is absolutely no way to win in this environment.
No, but you are relying on a fellow who's shown good judgment in the past, and quite frankly, I'm not sure that he's going to seek another term.
No.
So I mean, this is if you got to have one guy in charge of it, Isaacson's not a bad guy.
Well, he's somebody who's very well respected on both sides of the aisle. He's a very fair-minded individual, and I think he'll approach it like he does everything else.
I'm sorry, Rusty. I didn't mean to cut you short. Steve, are there lessons, given that, Julianne makes a point that the Alabama Senate race is not about anything now except Roy Moore's conduct, even though Doug Jones hasn't been talking about it, clearly he's smart enough to let the Republicans, fall on their own swords. Are we going, though, does that make it completely unique? And therefore, it won't have any lessons for how the Trump wing of the party is doing in statewide elections. We saw in Virginia a different story. Is this just going to be a one-off?
Well, I mean, we may look at some undercurrents and do some exit polling and see what affected some people and turnout. Turnout's going to be a key. So we may see some things there. But it's going to certainly be a unique race. And we're not going to learn as much from it as we did in the legislative races in Georgia and Virginia this last election.
Let me ask you three people, Steve, Julianne, and Rusty. You all spend a lot of time at the state capitol every session. The state capitol doesn't have a terrific reputation when it comes to male-female relationships.
Well,
what impact is what's happening
I certainly think people are going to come forward. You talk about Senator Lena Perrin. I think she's talked about it with some issues for us to look at next session, or at least talk about. I mean, legislators should have sexual harassment training, and so should other staff members of the Capitol. So we probably can do more and should do more at our state capitol, as businesses across the state should do more in making sure that people are more aware of these complex issues and people are trained and understand what they're doing and how it affects others.
I agree with Steve. Simply put, I agree with everything you just said.
Well, my daughter worked at the state capitol a few years ago, and I felt compelled to sit down and talk to her about that environment. And I listen to her now. She's in the entertainment industry. She's in Los Angeles. She's in the staging world. And it's just the story she tells about what she goes through in the entertainment world is, as a father, is chilling and very troublesome. We have to get our arms around this. I mean, we cannot, it's not acceptable, and we have to figure out what as political leaders, what our role in helping clean this mess up.
Meanwhile, Julianne, before we move out of this subject entirely, not only are we once again revisiting questions about women who've come forward about Donald Trump, but we're also suddenly Bill Clinton's conduct is being reexamined. You even got Kirsten Gillibrand, United States Senator from New York, making a rather startling statement saying he should have resigned when the Lewinsky episode came to light.
Well, I think that a lot of people are looking back on their actions over time and realizing that they should have handled things differently. I think that we as Republicans, you know, back during the Clinton era, we were appalled when, you know, when James Carville said, if you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, you never know what you're going to get, in response to the allegations against Bill Clinton. I mean, can you imagine if a Republican said that now?
You know, I've got to tell you, I'd completely forgotten.
But actually,
that
they are in Alabama.
I haven't heard anything like that.
They are what?
Saying things like, if you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park.
Well, I haven't seen anything like that. Well, and it certainly hasn't made national news.
Well, in fact, there was a robocall that we're aware of that went out in Alabama, which purports to be from the Washington Post telling women, we are looking for your stories of Roy Moore's sexual harassment against you, and we're paying for it. We know it's a phony call. But that said, I think, pair that with what we're talking about. Steve, I'd forgotten about that James Carville line.
Yeah,
That should have been explosive and immediately condemned then. It wasn't. But now, for sure, in this environment, you can't say things like that. And yeah, he wouldn't even say that today.
You know, I think we can be grateful we're changing. You know, back in the 60s, all this stuff was, the media knew things, and they would keep it quiet. It was an understanding where things weren't exposed. And that has changed over years, and we are better for it, and we just need to keep moving ahead.
All right, I got to get a second break in, and we will. When we come back, let's just talk a little about some of the aspects of the tax reform bill that is now obviously passed the entire House by a substantial majority and has gone through the Senate Finance Committee. The showdown is still ahead. And then we'll talk about another issue. Did any of you hear that big boom at about 7:30 or so this morning? That was $214 million of our money being destroyed in a matter of seconds. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, oligarchs from Russia and former Soviet bloc countries who became business partners with Donald Trump. We talk with Jake Bernstein, whose new book is about the Panama Papers, leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm that created thousands of offshore shell companies where corporations and wealthy individuals, including some of those oligarchs, hid their money. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. So I have to admit to all of you, to those of you in the studio, but to listeners as well, I have found it a little tricky to figure out how we're going to really drill down on the tax reform measure that we're seeing play out in Washington, and that's because it's a Rorschach test. We can hear all the Republican voices in the world say, yes, this is a benefit for middle class taxpayers, and the rich are going to get hit with bigger costs. We hear Democrats saying the exact opposite. And it will take more than a few minutes on this show to get to the bottom of that. I do want to play one example, I think, of just how sharply the lines are drawn. This was a committee hearing last week on the tax measure in the Senate. You'll hear Democrat Sherrod Brown and Committee Chair Orrin Hatch trading angry accusations, beginning with Sherrod Brown, who you'll hear basically is talking about what he says is a Democrat, the farce of middle class tax breaks really is. Let's listen.
We know companies don't just give away higher wages. They just don't give away higher wages just because they have more money. So just spare us the bank shot, spare us the sarcasm and the satire, and let's move.
I'm going to spare it, but I'm going to just say to you that I come from the poor people, and I've been here working my whole stinking career for people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break. I think you guys overplay that all the time, and it gets old. I get kind of sick and tired of it. True, it's a nice political play.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it's not true.
With all due respect, I get sick and tired of the richest people.
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
Getting richer and
regular
richer.
Order.
We do a tax.
Regular order.
Middle class.
Wait a minute. Regular order.
And over and over again.
Wait just
how many
a second.
Times do we do this before we learn this, Mr. Chairman?
Listen. I've honored you by allowing you to spout off here. And what you said was not right. That's all I'm saying. I come from the lower middle class originally. We didn't have anything. So don't spew that stuff on me. I get a little tired of that crap. And let me just say something. If you didn't, if we worked together, we could pull this country out of every mess it's in. And we could do a lot of the things that you're talking about, too. And I think I've got a reputation of having worked together with Democrats.
Let's start with Chip.
Not starting with Chip. I did it. I've done it for years. I've got more bills.
Start with Chip today.
I got more bills passed than everybody on this committee put together. Now, all I can say is I like you personally very much, but I'm telling you, this bullcrap that you guys throw out here really gets old after a while. To do it right at the end of this.
That's Orrin Hatch, the last voice you heard, and Sherrod Brown, he talks about CHIP. You all know the Children's Health Insurance Plan here in Georgia called Peach Care. He's pointing out the fact that Congress has not reauthorized it, and those funds, which are still existing, are about to expire in states around the country. All right, everybody. So who says it isn't fun to be in the United States Senate these days? This is the problem. I don't know how you talk about this without some sort of fact checker who is omniscient enough to know what the real story is, Rusty Paul.
People wonder, you know, is the problem Congress? And really, Congress is nothing more than the American people looking at themselves in the mirror. This is who we are as a country.
Wow.
And we have these divides, we have these splits, and you would hope that there's a political center out there somewhere where we can come together and reconcile. But what you're seeing now, instead of finding middle ground compromise, that's become a four-letter word. And now we're moving further and further apart. And there's no, when the Democrats are in power, my side just says, all right, you guys are in power, you figure it out. And now the Republicans are in power with only a two-vote majority, which is the worst situation in the world to be in if you're a leader, because you've got two people can hold you up on everything. There's no sense of us being a united country where we have common problems, where we work together. It's that we're two different worlds and we can't reconcile them. And as long as we've got that, we're going to continue to have this huge divide that's going to drive our country further and further apart.
Jim, one thing we do know, let me get this in because I think we both have agreed that this is something really worth looking at. One thing we do know for a fact is that the Republican tax bills in both houses it hurts college and postgraduate students. The interest on college loans is eliminated, a deduction for the interest. And if you're a postgraduate student and you're working as a teaching assistant or whatever, you now have to pay taxes on the free tuition, on the value of the tuition you're not having to pay because you're working for the school.
And there's one more. And that is, I've got many friends who have left journalism to go to work in places like Emory University, where the children of employees are allowed on campus tuition free, or at least at a reduced rate, and that will now be accounted as income.
So, Steve, I understand Republicans are looking at a huge deficit, $1.5 trillion, and looking to save money every place they can. Well, why would you want to discourage higher education?
Well, I don't know. I don't understand that. I don't understand how Rand Paul and some others who have fought against the deficit and growing the deficit can support a tax plan that does that. Also, when you look at this plan, you can argue about how much wealthy people are helped or not. But when you look at down the road, that $1.5 trillion deficit, that's going to affect people when we cut out transit or infrastructure spending or services. You know, that's going to affect middle and lower class people, and it just doesn't seem the right way to go for me.
Julianne, you are a conservative Republican, and I would bet that deficits are not your favorite present to open up underneath the Christmas tree.
No, definitely not. I agree with you. This is not a perfect bill. They rarely are. And there's a lot of work to be done on it. I disagree with that portion of the bill that Jim was just talking about a moment ago with regard to students and student loans. However, something has to be done. And the fact that there is a bill moving forward, and the fact that they are talking about it, and the fact that they are trying to come up with ways to solve some of these deficit problems is the right thing to do. And, you know, I applaud Congress for moving forward on this because they have had many different issues that have fallen behind, including health care reform.
And the most interesting thing that's happened in the last 24 hours is you've got signals from the Senate that they're dropping the Rand Paul amendment.
The individual mandate. The White House had pushed for it, said we want that to be part of the bill, that you will eliminate the individual mandate. In fact, it was the White House, Mick Mulvaney, over the weekend in one of the shows who said, no, we're taking that out. We know it's a potential poison pill. So we'll watch how that moves forward. All right. Next Monday, we're going to devote a good portion of our show to really trying to drill down a bit more. Connor Sen from Bloomberg Views, who writes about financial and economic matters, will be joining us, and we'll have a couple other panelists who can help us with that issue. All right. I said before, if you heard a big boom this morning at 7:30, it was $214 million going up in smoke. Jim Galloway, the Georgia Dome, Tom Faust points out to me that I think it was 28 years ago on Wednesday, the 22nd, that they broke ground for the Georgia Dome. And now it's back in the ground.
It's back in the ground. I don't know if you saw that explosion. I was at a campaign event this morning where a woman expressed exactly what I was thinking. She saw, you know, there was the implosion. The plume of dust went up, and it went right over the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and I was saying, oh, my goodness, the gears are going to get so clogged up that it's not going to work.
Well, they got enough problems trying to make that darn roof work as it is. Steve Henson, what do we think about the fact that back in 1990-91 session, the legislature agreed that this was a hugely important project for the state and built it through the World Congress Authority with $214 million of state money, and it's gone.
Yeah, well, it was a great investment. First of all, it started under Joe Frank Harris in 1988, and by the time I got there in 91, we were already long into it. But it was a great investment. It's been a great business promoter in Georgia. You know, we spent $214 million. Now we're $380 million. The new dome costs $1.6 billion. So we can see how much the price tag's gone up from new materials. And a sideway, the dome, all the concrete in the dome would do a sidewalk from Atlanta to Cincinnati. I had to throw that in.
But to Steve's point here, it was funded with the hotel motel tax, if I'm not mistaken. And in the state capital, that's really not considered a tax, because those people don't vote. They're from out of town.
Still, how do we feel about a 28-year-old building being leveled? Or am I the only one who wonders about that sort of thing?
Well, it made me a little sad to watch
Just
it.
Just sad.
No. It made me sad and a little bit angry, but I'm trying to remain lighthearted about it. I saw a tweet this morning. I forgot who it was from, but it was pretty cute. It said, now that the Georgia Dome has imploded, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium is seeing now what we can do and what we can accomplish so that it better behave itself. So,
you know, history, we spent a lot of time talking about history, but in Atlanta, history is so disposable.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You know, I mean, I remember when I first moved to the metro area in 74, there was a regular headline in Jim's newspaper, they're digging up Peachtree again. And, you know, we don't get enamored with buildings, and they're disposable in our culture here, and that's just one
in
a long list.
Well, the Georgia Dome is now history. Last thing before we have to leave you today, we are, the Political Rewind team is going to take Wednesday off. They deserve a long weekend. So we're going to play a show that you'll like as much as we enjoy doing it. We're going to be talking with Curtis Wilkie. He is you may have heard Chris Matthews on our show last week call him a legend among political journalists. He is. He reported for the Boston Globe on their national scene for many, many years. He and his Boston colleague, his Boston Globe colleague, Tom Oliphant, wrote a book about John Kennedy's campaign to get into the White House. And so on November 22nd, Wednesday, the anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, we are going to play a show in which Curtis talks about that campaign. Georgia plays a big role. One of those roles has to do with what happened when Martin Luther King was arrested for the very first time for a sit-in at the Magnolia Room at Rich's. The King family wanted either Richard Nixon or John Kennedy. This was 3 weeks before the election, hoped someone would take the time to talk to Coretta Scott King. The Kennedy team all said, we don't want to go near this. We got too many Southern governors who are supporting our campaign. But Sergeant Shriver was one of those who said, we've got to bring this to Kennedy's attention. So here's just one of the stories Curtis tells on the show on Wednesday.
Kennedy's in a hotel room at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and Shriver waits until Pierre Salinger and Ted Sorensen and Kenny O'Donnell, all three top assistants to Kennedy who would oppose this, until they left the room, and he's finally alone with Jack Kennedy, and he lays out the case for making a call. And Kennedy says, well, sure, you know, give me her number and I'll dial her up and I'll call her. And he did. The conversation only lasted 2 or 3 minutes, but it was comforting to Mrs. King. Dr. King's father, Daddy King, who was a very prominent figure himself, had been prepared to vote for Nixon. And he announced that he was changing. He was going to vote for Jack Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy is furious when he learns that his brother has made this call. And Kennedy, Bobby, goes off in a snit, and it feels like they have blown the election, that they've blown the possibility of carrying the Southern states because of this one phone call.
By the way, as Chris Matthews said the other day on our show, Bobby Kennedy knew how to learn and change. By that night, as angry as he was about the potential for losing the Southern Democratic governors, like in Georgia, he realized that Martin Luther King had not been treated by well by the court system, and he was the one who led the effort to get Martin Luther King out of jail. So that's Curtis Wilkie coming up on Wednesday, our show about John F. Kennedy on the 54th anniversary of his murder in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, Mayor Rusty Paul, Julianne Thompson, Senator Steve Henson, Minority Leader in the State Senate, Jim Galloway. I hope you all have a great Thanksgiving. We will see you all back here on Monday, but please listen on Wednesday to Curtis Wilkie. Have a good day, Galloway.
Yeah, eat some turkey.
Yeah, all right. Thanks to Tom Faust, to Tyler Morris, to Olivia Rheingold for your work on the show today. As I said, I'm Bill Nygut. I'll see you all back here for a live show next Monday at 2 o'clock.